It's about exploring physics and whether it's for you or not. So just enjoy it. Talk to as many people as you can. Try to absorb what's in the environment here. And most of all, have fun. So yeah, Dave gave me a very nice introduction. I don't want to speak for too long. I'm much more interested in hearing what questions you have. But let me just give you a little perspective on where physics is right now and what makes the current time so interesting. And I should warn you, it's totally a personal opinion, and many people will disagree with me, and you'll see lots of controversy all over the internet. But they're all wrong. Okay. Physics is at an amazing junction because we have just begun to gather some of the deepest information that we've ever had. The last 3 years have been completely amazing as far as experiment goes. Okay, and I'm going to come back to theory. But experiment is a crucial, crucial part of physics. I believe that we learn from the universe teaches us things, and essentially I believe that's fundamental to progress, human society. The history of progress is essentially one of people learning from the universe. It's just amazing what it can teach us, of understanding, trying to understand how the universe works, and then using that understanding to improve society, improve our lives, and build a future. So the universe teaches us stuff, and we better listen, okay? And we better look. And what's happened over the last 3 years has been amazing. 2012, of course, the Higgs boson was discovered. This is maybe the one of the greatest intellectual achievements of humankind. The reason is it was predicted nearly 50 years earlier by a lonely little fellow called Peter Higgs, who has an amazing personal story. There's a funny story behind it, which if you learn about it, you'll discover why you shouldn't believe the conventional wisdom and why you should follow your own path. So Higgs is an amazing example of that. Anyway, he pursued a little idea he had. He wrote a paper in Physical Review Letters, which is 1.5 pages long. Okay, and he actually beat Einstein because Einstein's E equals mc² paper is 3 pages long. I thought that was the shortest paper in terms of amazing theoretical discoveries, but then I read Higgs' paper and it's half the size. So he wrote this little paper and he basically said, when you put relativity and quantum mechanics together and what we know of quantum fields, there's only one way, or there seems to be a way, of explaining how particles get their masses and charges, how those masses and charges are determined. And he was inspired by superconductors, actually. It was another example of nature teaching us things. We learn from real phenomena, then we try to extract theoretical principles, and we try to apply those principles to fundamental physics. So he'd learned something from condensed matter physics and superconductivity, that there can be a field, and a field is something which takes values everywhere across space. There could be a field, which later became called Higgs field, and this field just fills space, just like water in the sea. And the particles that travel through, and the forces that travel through this field are just like the fish in the ocean. The manner in which they travel and move is controlled by this Higgs field through which they move. So the Higgs field is just a medium in which we all live, everything lives. So he had this idea, and he said maybe this Higgs field controls the masses and charges of particles. And he wrote down a few formulae, submitted it to the journal. It was rejected. That's another thing you should learn, is that rejection is a sign you're on the right track. Okay. if what you do is accepted immediately, it's probably not interesting. So it was rejected, and they said, we want an experimental prediction from you. You're not predicting anything new. And he said, oh, well, by the way, it's clear that if this theory is true, there must be a particle. And the particle is just a ripple in the Higgs field. It's like a sound wave in water. And you can tell the difference between water and air by how quickly and how sound is transmitted. And there should be a little wave which carries energy through the Higgs field, and that would be the Higgs particle or Higgs boson. So he added one line to the paper: there must be a particle, its mass is obvious from the equations, and that was that. 50 years later, almost 50 years later, people built a 10 billion euro machine, the greatest experiment of all time, the Large Hadron Collider, producing amounts of data which would have been unimaginable even one decade earlier. This is the leading edge of science. It's the same laboratory that created the World Wide Web and the Internet. These people know about data. And so they gather data in huge volumes, sifted through it, and lo and behold, there's the Higgs boson, exactly with the properties described by Higgs. So that's a great discovery, a huge triumph for the field. But the amazing thing is that most theorists following this discovery were walking around with very long faces. Oh no, my theory's dead. Why? Because for 50 years, people hadn't been idle. They'd been developing elaborations of Higgs theories. They'd been adding new fields and supersymmetry and strings and extra dimensions, all kinds of other stuff. And none of that other stuff was there. Okay, just the little Higgs boson. So nature chose the simplest option. And it's a deeply puzzling option, okay? Because theorists had invented rather elaborate arguments why there just had to be other stuff. Couldn't just be a Higgs boson. There must be particles called superpartners. There must be dark matter particles called WIMPs. It would be nice if there were extra dimensions and if the Large Hadron Collider even made tiny black holes which would evaporate by Hawking radiation. None of that was seen, okay? Nature just chose the simplest option. And right now, all the theorists around the world are scratching their heads and wondering, how did nature get away with it? How did nature get away with being so simple? Now, the next year, which was last year, the Planck satellite mapped the whole universe on the largest visible scales, 14 billion light years. And they made these beautiful maps of the radiation coming from the hot Big Bang. And that stuff that I work on, predictions for what they would see. And lo and behold, what did they see? The simplest possible pattern. You can describe the entire pattern of density variations. In other words, the fact the universe isn't exactly uniform. It has lumps and bumps. And you can describe the entire pattern with just two numbers. Okay? Roughly speaking, the lumps and bumps in the early universe are at a level of one part in 100,000. So they're very tiny. If the density is one, these variations are one part in 100,000 from place to place. And in their spatial form is that they are Gaussian noise. Now, you may not know what that is, but basically when you do statistics, you learn about the normal distribution. This is the most, the simplest distribution you can possibly have. It also happens to be the distribution of fields in the quantum vacuum, such as the Higgs field. And this spatial pattern, which is seen in the sky, is almost perfectly scale invariant, meaning that bumps on every scale have the same strength, and they are randomly distributed, just like ripples on the surface of the sea. So that's what's seen. And that seems to be enough to account for the formation of galaxies, stars, everything else that we see in the universe. So somehow, what experiment has discovered is this extreme simplicity in nature on the tiniest scales, a billion times smaller than an atom, and extreme simplicity on the larger scales, right? 10 trillion times larger than the solar system, which is what the Planck satellite measured. Nature's very simple. It's really complicated in between, okay? And we live in between. In fact, it's a curious fact that the size of a cell, a living cell, is actually the geometric mean between these two very tiny scales. The scale of the entire visible universe, which is set by the vacuum energy called the dark energy, and the scale of the Planck length, which is set by quantum gravity. And life is halfway in between on a geometric scale. And that's how the universe seems to work. It has complexity in the middle, simplicity on the tinier scale, simplicity on the very larger scale. We don't have a good theory of why this is so. We just don't have good theory yet. So lots of theories have been tossed in the waste bin, which is wonderful, okay? Because it would be even better if one of them was right. But next best, you prove them wrong. That's still progress. And so this is the perfect time for a place like Perimeter to exist, because I believe it could be Large Hadron Collider will discover something next year, next couple of years. They're still looking, and they may discover WIMPs or supersymmetry or something that was expected, or they may discover nothing. If they discover nothing, and if the Planck satellite continues to find this extreme simplicity in nature, the ball is in the court of theory. How on earth did the universe, how does it work? How do we explain the simplicity? It's crying out for some new theoretical principle which will explain why things are as simple as they are. So there are a lot of candidates for such a principle. I'm working on some of them. Other people in this institute are working on them. Nobody has the answer yet, but it's just a spectacular time to get into physics. I honestly feel that we're entering a period similar to the one at the beginning of the 20th century. Right, the end of the 20th century, classical mechanics was fully developed. The theory of heat was fully developed. People thought that's the end for physics. They had electromagnetism from Maxwell, so they understood radio waves and all that stuff. And then slowly it dawned on people there was this huge contradiction, two huge contradictions right in the heart of their theories. And those contradictions led to special relativity and quantum mechanics, which were the foundation of the whole of 20th century physics. So the early 20th century was this revolutionary period where basically everything that was known previously was turned upside down and new foundations were laid. And I feel we are entering a similar period now. It's really hard to predict revolutions. I can't wait for it to happen. But our job at Perimeter is create the ideal environment for it to happen. Okay, so the way I like to think of Perimeter, we have about 200 researchers here, and any one of them could make the next big breakthrough, and that's how we plan the institute. So everyone has to be treated really well, okay, because you never know who's going to have that idea, all right? We all secretly hope it's us, but we also all understand that if we can help other people, and if one of those people we help turns out to be the one who has the key idea, you know, that's a huge contribution we can make. So Perimeter is a completely unique place. I'm happy to talk more about it. I don't think there's been a center like this in history, let alone elsewhere in the world. And it's getting better all the time. But people like you, young people like you, are what gives all of us optimism. I mean, basically, we work in the hardest field in science. It's the most difficult field in science. Do not go into this field if you're faint-hearted, okay? This is the most difficult field in science. The discoveries made in theoretical physics can't be compared to anything else. They have huge applicability. They describe fundamental behavior of the world. There is no other field with the same precision as theoretical physics. We can predict things mathematically to a trillion decimal places. There's no other field which comes anywhere near that. Okay, so it's a totally unique field, but it's damn hard. Okay, and we are well aware of the fact that we're basically slightly evolved monkeys, who for some strange reason are able to gain this insight, but we're not really equipped for the job. Okay, and so it's kind of miraculous how far we've come. I do believe we will go much further. And I think the discoveries which hopefully will be made here and other places about explaining the vacuum, explaining the great mysteries in physics, those discoveries are going to give us technologies which will completely change the future. It might be space travel throughout the universe. It might be new forms of computers which think much better than we do. And which we sort of code for. We're like the DNA for the next generation of life that will supersede us. There are all kinds of things which are possibilities which are on the horizon. So I think, you know, I just want to encourage you. This is a wonderful field. It's damn difficult. But I encourage you to explore and play and have fun here. And let us know how you think we could improve Perimeter. Because it's really designed for people like you. And especially as you grow older, I hope you'll think about coming and taking the Psi program and being a postdoc here and having a research chair here. This is all possible. So I'm open to any questions. Yeah.
As director of PI, like, yep. What kind of duties do you have other than, of course, doing research?
Too many. the main role I play is to decide and implement a strategy for the growth of the Institute. So I've got to do this in discussion with my faculty. So we have about 30 faculty members of varying degrees of seniority. And some are half-time, some are full-time. We have about 21 full-time faculty. But basically, it's up to me to figure out where the best opportunities in physics lie, which people we should hire, how we should support them, And essentially how to keep raising the standard in the Institute so that it actually becomes the best place in the world and so that it actually is the place where the next discoveries can be made. So that's my job. Yeah.
And with all of these responsibilities, can you find time for your work?
With great difficulty. And I was just doing research, and that's why I'm late. Yes, I can. I'll give you an honest answer. I've been director for 5 years, and the first 5 years I was just totally focused on the growth of this place. I mean, we doubled the size of the Institute, the building. We trebled the size of the faculty. We've hired some of the leading researchers in the world. Perimeter's the play, you know, there's a prize for young physicists, which is a good measure of how successful you're being. Perimeter's the only institute in the world to have won this prize twice for the top young physicist in the world, theoretical physicist in the world. Davide Gaiotto and Freddy Cacciazzo won it in 2012 and 2013. So we're the coming place, okay? So we've achieved that. My own research spans a very wide area, but I am particularly obsessed with the Big Bang, what happened at the Big Bang. And I think our existing theories are very deficient. And in fact, I was going to mention this, but this year there was a big fuss about BICEP 2. You may have heard about it. I was the first person internationally to say that I doubted this result. Stephen Hawking called me out, and he said he won his bet with me. that he said bicep 2 is correct, it's Six Sigma, has to be right. Trouble is he doesn't know anything about astrophysics and how messy it is. This is not the Higgs boson. This is not particle physics, okay? Particle physics is the most precise. This is probably going on the web. He'll hate me for it. That's fine. He's a good friend. He says equally frank things. Particle physics is the most precise and highly developed scientific field of all. Okay, so when they say something is five sigma, it's five sigma. Okay, they've controlled it. They have blind checks when they do their data analysis. It's usually blind, so the people don't know the result they're aiming at. They have all this. It's been established over a century since Rutherford. Okay, this is really a very, very developed field. Cosmology is not like that. Okay, cosmology is a new field. These experiments are very difficult. You're looking through the Earth's atmosphere, say it for bicep, looking through the atmosphere, there are clouds, there's junk, there's cosmic rays, there's all kinds of interference. Then you're looking through the galaxy, which is full of dust and stars and magnetic fields. All of these things create noise in your data and contamination. And then you're looking through the universe, 14 billion light years, you know, there's all kinds of stuff out there we don't fully understand. And what they claimed is that we could see gravitational waves created at the Big Bang. So tremendously exciting. But honestly, when I saw the paper and read it, my heart sank. It was not a well-written paper. There were at least five problems evident immediately, things they hadn't explained properly. I talked to some of the experimentalists. They gave me no reassurance. Quite the contrary. They said, yeah, we don't know. And so when Stephen Hawking said, I've won my bet, you know, I said, oh, no, you haven't. you know, good science requires confirmation. And I'm waiting for confirmation. And I don't see why they are so confident they have not just seen dust, okay, or what's called synchrotron radiation from the galaxy. So I waited, and other people plunged in, and basically the current state of play is the result is in severe doubt. Many people are very, very skeptical about it. Luckily, there are about five other experiments racing after, and this will be confirmed. So I'm very interested in this, but I'm skeptical the result will work out. Now, part of the reason for my skepticism is I don't believe the theory, which is the most popular theory, which initially it was claimed that bicep confirmed. But then as soon as bicep started to weaken, the advocates of that theory said, oh, it doesn't matter. If bicep goes away, it doesn't affect the validity of the theory. Now, this should worry you. If you have a theory which, when something is measured, you say, oh, yes, it's confirmation. And if that signal goes away, they say, oh, it doesn't matter. What kind of a theory is it? Does it predict anything? And in fact, this is the Achilles heel of the theory. It's extremely adjustable theory. So almost no matter what is measured, you can adjust the theory to accommodate it. That's the theory of inflation. I don't find it very exciting. I worked on it for many years. I pioneered part of it myself, the theory of bubbles and eternal inflation. We did the first calculations, but as time went on, I became disillusioned with it. And I think it's not very scientific the way it's done right now. You know, theoretical physics is the field. We have Maxwell's equations. We have Einstein's equations. We have Dirac's equations. These do not involve lots of, you know, tweaks, bells and whistles. This is not financial mathematics or climate modeling, okay? This is precision. Theoretical physics is totally unique in this respect. In the whole of the Standard Model of particle physics, you know, there are 20 parameters, but it describes billions of phenomena. So this is I think we shouldn't compromise those standards. We need theories which are predictive, which are powerful, which are accurate. And when we have to add bells and whistles, we shouldn't delude ourselves. We should say, well, you know, it doesn't really work, so I'm going to cook it up this and that way, so it kind of works. But I shouldn't pretend I've predicted anything. After all they're predicting is two numbers, the same two numbers that describes the pattern on the sky. And you ask, how many numbers are there in the theory that's predicting those two numbers? Well, it's almost always more than two. Three numbers, right? So you're fitting two numbers with three numbers. Well, congratulations. I mean, that doesn't, shouldn't convince anyone. Landau said, famous theoretical physicist, is quoted as saying that any competent theorist can fit experimental data with one free parameter, and any fool can fit it with two. And basically, inflation is doing it with three. So, you know, it's not a huge success. On the positive side, we are trying to understand what happens at singularities. The Big Bang is the point where Einstein's equations fail. And there are some very interesting clues as to what happens at that point. A lot of the work is very mathematical. We have to understand how to deal with Einstein's equations for gravity in situations where the curvature of space-time becomes infinite. And it's not at all impossible. It's just very hard. So we have some ideas, which I'm excited about. They point to, and then there's this massive clue. So this is something I'm very excited about. The Large Hadron Collider result, if you take the measured value of the Higgs boson mass, and you say, okay, throughout space, there's this Higgs field. And it has a certain value of 250 GeV, 250 times the mass of the proton. And so this field fills space. Now you say, okay, let me take the theory. I know all its parameters because they've been measured. Let me ask, what happens if the Higgs field gets larger? And it turns out that as the Higgs field, if you imagine sort of changing the Higgs field in space, that requires energy. So the energy in space would go up, but then when it gets to a certain level, about 10 billion GeV, turns out the energy goes down again. And this can all be calculated with very high confidence. And so it goes down again, and when it gets beyond 10 billion GeV, it falls below the energy in our vacuum today. And what that's telling us is that the universe in the future can actually tunnel, can quantum tunnel from the state it's in today into a lower energy state. Okay, that's what's going to happen in the future. It's not we won't be dominated by this dark energy forever. It's unstable. So what I've been studying is how that process happens, how this instability happens. And there are some amazing clues that not only is there a lower energy state, but it turns out if you look at the standard model, and you take it up to the Planck scale, which is the energy scale associated with gravity, the shortest distance scale in physics. If you trace it up to there, the theory becomes scale invariant. What we say is scale invariant. Now, what that means is that the theory looks like there is no intrinsic scale. So, you know, usually in physics, you do length in meters, time in seconds, mass in kilograms. But one of the, you know, we also think about space and time as very concrete things. So it turns out one of the most appealing ideas for explaining the simplicity in nature is there is no scale in physics. Scale is something which is generated dynamically. If you write down the fundamental laws of physics, there will be no scale. All there is relative scales. You can compare the size of things, but there's no intrinsic scale. If this is correct, string theory is wrong, because string theory says there's a string scale, the scale of the string. So from this point of view, now it turns out that the standard model extrapolated to high energies becomes scale invariant at the Planck scale. It's kind of a miracle. We don't know why. It's one of the hints we've got from the LHC. And personally, I think it may have something to do with the fact that the future of our universe will be to go unstable and to create the next Big Bang. And so I've been interested for a long time in the idea the universe is cyclic in its evolution. I I find it implausible that everything sprang into existence at some time in the past, and like equally implausible that it will just continue indefinitely in the future in a sort of diluted away nothingness. And this discovery of the Higgs is lend support to that idea, that in fact there seems to be a very natural mechanism within the Standard Model for creating another Big Bang. And so this can be studied with more or less precision. There are still things we have to resolve, but that's the direction I'm most excited about. Yeah.
And do you think that's the first Big Bang that happened, or is it like a circle?
You know, I'm agnostic. I don't really have strong philosophical or other views, but it's certainly true that a cyclical universe is, I would say, the most conservative possibility. You know, the key to great physics is to be as conservative as you can while still being consistent with what you know. I mean, you don't want to just leap over the edge of the cliff, okay? We know an incredible amount, and you have to respect everything we know. So in that sense, you need to be very conservative. Now, what we know about physics is a set of laws for describing how things evolve in time. That's what physics is. It's nothing more, nothing less, okay? But for the universe, there's this paradox that it seems to have started in a singularity, one point, the whole of space at one point. This inflation theory says nothing about that, by the way. So that's a deep paradox, that it starts at a point. And what it says is that we're looking at things the wrong way. We need some kind of bigger view of those laws of physics, which can explain how the universe came through that point. Now, I don't know, you probably haven't done complex numbers, or have you, in math? Some of you have. Okay, so the key to new ideas in physics is often connecting to deep mathematical principles, okay? One of the most powerful principles in mathematics or ideas is that of complex numbers. That as well as ordinary numbers, real numbers, you have imaginary numbers. So in fact, you have I, and I squared is minus one. So if you look at my book, you'll all get a copy of my book. One of the chapters is called Our Imaginary Reality, okay, which is my poor attempt at a joke. But the imaginary number turns out to be the key in quantum mechanics. So this is really what was one of the most important aspects of Heisenberg's breakthrough when he invented quantum mechanics. He said, let's abandon the idea that the position of a particle is a real number, and a position and momentum are real numbers. And right in the middle of his equations is this I. Okay. So everything should really be thought of as being partly real and partly imaginary. It's like every number in complex numbers, every number has a real part and an imaginary part. So this was an idea developed by mathematicians in the 15th century for solving algebraic equations, and then used in Fourier series and used by Euler for probably the most famous formula in mathematics. I'm sure you've seen it, the most amazing formula. E to the I pi equals minus one. There's the I. So this equation combines calculus, you know, the exponential is to do with exponential growth. Then I squared is minus one, that's the imaginary number. Pi comes into the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter, okay? And this combination is minus one. I mean, that's pretty mysterious, okay? But this is very well established in mathematics. And it's the basis for many, many things, Fourier series and so on. And what Heisenberg did is put that number I in the middle of physics. So that's how the world works. It uses this I. There's no doubt about that. And one of the ideas I'm pursuing, let's say ideas. Okay. One of the ideas is the fact that You see, when you think about numbers, say I have some number z, I can, if z would include a real part, we call x, and then this is the imaginary part. So this is the real, this is the imaginary. This is the coefficient of I, and x and y can be any numbers from minus infinity to infinity. We usually plot these numbers in a complex plane, what's called a complex plane. So here's the x, and here's the y. And one of the ideas I've been pursuing is that the Big Bang occurs, if we call this plane the time, the complex time plane, and we say time has a real and imaginary part, the Big Bang occurred at time zero. Okay, we can just define it to be at time zero. That's when there's a singularity. And then what we have shown is that it is possible to solve Einstein's equations. You can't go through this point because the equations are singular there. You have infinities. But you can go around it. And the solution is still unique. And that actually, that's a very simple idea, but it's a way of describing the passage past the singularity in terms of complex numbers. And so I'm busy exploring that idea. I think it will give predictions, but it's really one of the simplest possibilities for explaining what happened at the Big Bang. What this means, actually, is that our classical notion of the universe, a classical picture of the universe, cannot be represented in real numbers at the time of the Big Bang. But maybe it can in complex numbers. So that's one idea which we're pursuing. That's a very, very conservative idea. No new equations, just extending time to the complex plane. Yeah.
So this idea says that just time has an imaginary part, or just the three dimensions of space also have it?
In principle, everything has real and imaginary parts. Okay, and in general relativity, it's not really the time, it's really the metric. It's called a metric. It's the quantity that describes the geometry of space. Time is really a parameter. It's not a dynamical quantity in GR. The metric is. So what I really mean here is the metric. The metric is complex. But yes, it's equally true for space and for time. And in fact, it's one of the sort of mysteries in quantum mechanics. Why the world can be approximately described in real numbers, okay? Nobody has given a completely successful account of why this is true. In quantum mechanics, things can be complex as well as real. And one can see in certain cases why the imaginary part tends to cancel out, but there is no full explanation, in fact, for why the world So you may have heard of a phenomenon called quantum tunneling. Okay, so quantum tunneling is my special passion at the moment. Such a transition is an example of quantum tunneling. What quantum tunneling means is that if you have a theory, so a classical theory very often says that if your system is in a certain subset of its possible states, you know, so you've got some, I don't know, balls and springs, and they have some velocities and positions, okay? And it's in some particular configuration. Well, very often you'll find that it simply cannot get into another class of configurations. You know, one example is if I have a ball rolling on a hill or on some terrain, okay, and, you know, I give the ball some energy. Well, it will oscillate around there, but there is absolutely no way for it to get over here, right? In classical mechanics, because the energy is fixed and there's nothing you can do. It requires more energy than you have to get over this barrier and you're just stuck here. Okay, so it's like walking through a wall. We can't walk through a wall in classical theory. In quantum theory, we can. There's no problem walking through walls in quantum theory, okay? So in quantum theory, it's totally different. Quantum theory, we know, and this is called quantum tunneling, that this ball, even though it does not have enough energy to get over the barrier, It will leak through here. Okay, there's a wave function that describes how likely it is to find the ball in any place. And we know the wave function can never be confined. If this barrier is finite, the wave function always leaks through. So if the wall is finite, in quantum mechanics, I can walk through it. Okay, it may take exponentially long time, but in principle, I can do it. So quantum tunneling is a very profound distinction between quantum systems and classical systems. Quantum systems necessarily explore all of their possible states. Okay, you cannot be stopped from exploring all of their possible states. Classical systems generically do not explore all of their states. So quantum theory is much more kind of all-seeing. In fact, almost the definition of a quantum theory is it's a theory which can explore all of its possible states. So in quantum theory, you'd like to describe this tunneling. And so I've been studying this process again. There's a classic description of this given in the 1920s by George Gamow. That's how it describes radioactivity, how atomic nuclei emit particles. It's exactly this process. This description I was never happy with because the usual description doesn't tell you where is the particle at each moment of time. In the usual description, you solve for the wave function. Okay, so I might say, here's my initial wave function. So the particle is probably here. And I evolve this forward in time, and then the wave function leaks out. But the conventional description doesn't really tell you where the particle is during this leaking process. Okay. So in a recent paper, I reconsidered that and showed that in a certain regime where this tunneling is rare, is exponentially slow, there is a clear answer to where the particle is. Okay? And the answer is that it's in the complex plane. So a particle, when it tunnels, has a position. Okay, this is x. And you should think of the coordinate of the particle not just as a real number, but actually, it's allowed to be complex in quantum mechanics. And so in this complex x plane, maybe I should call it z, and then this is x and y. The way you get through the barrier is as follows. You oscillate around one vacuum, and then these oscillations grow, and they grow into shapes like this. The barrier is here. And basically, that is how a particle tunnels. It goes around the barrier in the complex plane. Okay, its coordinate becomes large and imaginary, and it just circumvents the barrier. Okay, so that's a new picture of tunneling, which I put in a recent paper. And it turns out there are actually experiments one can do to check that this is true, and these are now being planned. But this picture of quantum mechanics is halfway between fully quantum, which is very hard to conceptualize because the quantum world, you know, everything is doing everything all the time. It's very hard to conceptualize. In the classical world, you know, the world is a machine, and so given its state, it just marches forward in this boring, predictable way. So these are sort of two extreme opposites. This picture is halfway between the two. It's a classical picture of quantum tunneling, but involving complex numbers. And it's valid in a certain regime. It's valid when the tunneling is exponentially slow. Then this picture turns out to be extremely accurate. So this is actually a very, very elementary problem. And when I realized this way of describing it, you know, it's one of the great things about being a perimeter. I realized this way of describing, I thought somebody must have done this before. This has been known since the 1920s. It's in all the textbooks, the quantum tunneling. Somebody must have done it this way. So we had Yakir Aharonov visiting. He's one of our visiting research chairs. We have 35 of them. Stephen Hawking was the first. We have a whole number of these people. These are the most knowledgeable people in theoretical physics globally. He happened to be here. I mentioned it to him. I said, who has done this? And he said, oh, I don't think anyone has done it. So I said, come on, somebody must have done it. It's not difficult. And he said, oh, no, everything's like that in quantum mechanics. So he said all of his greatest discoveries were in things where everyone expected there was nothing new to be said. And so he's one of these people who just encourages you to rethink everything from first principles. And he was extremely supportive and invited me to a conference to speak about it and published this in a book he edited and so on. So it's actually through being at Perimeter I was encouraged to pursue this this line of research.
Yeah, yep. Alexandra,
I have my mind as, yeah, we can go on for another 10 minutes or so.
Okay, I have witnesses that I trust.
Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
How does the research in theoretical physics start? I think that you can try to explain a concept if you have the goal in your mind, but where does the initial idea come from? For instance, how did you come up with the idea that particle spiral around is a complex
thing? It's a funny thing. I came up with this idea because I hated another idea. Some people in physics are promoting this idea of a multiverse. Okay? So you may have heard of this. Some people who should know better. Okay? Some very intelligent people. And what they're claiming is that our patch of the universe, you know, has certain properties, but there may be other patches that have totally different properties, okay? And in fact, there may be an infinity of patches and they're all different, and we just happen to live in the one we live in, okay? It's not a very exciting idea because it can't be tested. We can't see the other patches. So why do we care about them if we can't see them? It's not really a scientific hypothesis, okay? So this is why I don't like it. Now, there's a big question, is it true? It might still be true. Even if we can't test it, we can't test everything, maybe it happens to be true. I kind of believe in my gut that for some reason we can explain the properties of the universe. That's what history has taught us. You know, why is it that Isaac Newton's discoveries in 1600 turn out to apply to basically the whole universe. And Maxwell's, you know, so I think we're on a journey. We don't know why this stuff works. We don't know why we can do it. But so far, all the evidence is we can understand everything. So I don't want to stop. I don't want to say there's some multiverse. I'm never going to explain it. It's all random. You know, I'm not so interested in that. So anyway, the short story is this multiverse hypothesis, people try to make it into a theory. And they linked it with inflation, this other theory I don't particularly like. Okay. So inflation is a good thing to link to because it's not very predictive. And you can adjust it to make bubbles. Okay. So actually, I worked on this. I wrote the first paper on these bubbles, I'm embarrassed to say. And these bubbles, okay, so basically you have this inflating universe that expands like mad. And then it makes bubbles in space. And each bubble can be different, okay? And each bubble, paradoxically, you think of a bubble as a finite thing, right? But actually, in general relativity, a bubble expands and it can grow and the interior of the bubble can be arbitrarily large. In fact, it becomes infinite. So each bubble within it has an infinite universe. And all these infinite universes cohabit the same inflating space-time. That's their picture, okay? And so that's the multiverse. You have many infinite universes all coexisting. This is very strange. But what I doubted was whether there were any real calculations behind this idea. Mostly it's just pictures. People draw pictures, they say, well, there's a multiverse, maybe this is... Maybe we can try to explain in some way something from the multiverse. But I doubted there were any serious calculations. So I said, okay, let me study the process of that bubble forming in a new way. And I want to very precisely specify what the state was before the bubble and the fact that I saw the bubble, and I want to find a description of how the bubble nucleated. What they were doing is simply drawing pictures. Honestly, very, very fancy theoretical physicists, very capable, but often they just draw pictures. There's no real math underlying it. So I tried to find these bubbles, and what I realized is that there was this flaw in the description of tunneling. This description developed by Gamow was suitable in a context where there was no time dependence. You have a nucleus sitting there, and basically it's nothing much happening, and then the particle jumps out. In the inflation context, totally different. The whole of space is expanding exponentially. So there's strong time dependence. And that wasn't accounted for properly in what people were doing. So I put that in, then I realized, actually, I can use that description in the simpler context as well. So it's a strange story. I mean, who would think you have to think about the multiverse in order to understand tunneling in some little one-electron system? I mean, it's ridiculous. But this is how we get inspired, is by sharing ideas about all kinds of things, very big picture things. And maybe all of those ideas are wrong. It doesn't really matter, okay? Because out of this kind of sea of ideas and discussion, maybe one idea will come out, and you can check it experimentally, and maybe it'll be important.
A few days ago, they told us the Schwarzschild radius.
Yes.
And I don't know why I realized that if you do that radius smaller, then it can be a complex time. And I started to think about all these questions that you just have described.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I just want to ask you now because I have the opportunity. So. It made me thought, I don't know why, with the matter-antimatter problem.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that maybe antimatter is more likely to be in the complex plane for some reason than in the real plane.
Could be. I don't know. Let me just say a little bit about black holes, because this has been one of the most enduring controversies in theoretical physics. You know, Stephen Hawking was sort of decades ahead of his time. And what his real insight was to appreciate that gravity, that quantum effects in gravity can be pretty interesting. Okay, most people had thought, you know, gravity governs stars and planets, and quantum effects govern atoms and molecules, and these have nothing to do with each other, right? Quantum, you still see it. People say quantum is important on the tiniest scale, right? But that's nonsense, actually, because the Planck satellite mapped the whole universe. And what we see are these fluctuations. And the pattern of those fluctuations looks just like quantum noise in the vacuum. It's a clue that actually the whole universe is governed by quantum mechanics. So it's only a clue, it's not for sure. But anyway, Stephen somehow foresaw all of this, that quantum would be really important in gravity and the universe. So his biggest idea was that black holes radiate, okay? So this is quantum tunneling. It's nothing but quantum tunneling, okay? Because what is a black hole? A black hole is a state where you collapse a star and the collapsed matter becomes so dense that light cannot escape, okay? The gravitational field of the mass is so strong that light is just forced to fall in. That's a black hole. So classically, I can make this object, and it can never return to the original state, the original universe. That's a classic case of quantum tunneling. Something is impossible, classically. I cannot access all the states because I'm stuck in a black hole. Quantum mechanics that doesn't do that, okay? And so what Hawking described is, if this is time, he described throwing the matter in, you form the black hole, and then he claimed this radiation would, so here's the black hole, it's getting smaller, And finally, it disappears. Okay, and it disappears through this Hawking radiation. And now, this is a very, very paradoxical process. And Hawking believed for a long time that information was lost in this process. That if I threw a book into the black hole, then whatever was written in the book could never be recovered. Even if I measured all the Hawking radiation and I tried to infer what made the hole, I could never detect what made the hole. This proposal, Hawking's proposal that information is lost in black holes, is inconsistent with quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics, you never lose information. It's always there. It's part of the definition of the theory. So there was a violent controversy. Eventually, Hawking retracted. So by the way, he all previous bets he has lost. This is another reason for me to doubt the bicep experiment. I think Hawking is really good at making great bets, which he loses. So this one he accepted, he had lost. But the truth is that no successful description of this process has ever been given. Okay, this quantum tunneling point of view actually tells you what you need to do to solve this problem. What you need to do is find a solution of general relativity of Einstein's equations, which is complex, not real. A quantum process is described in classical terms only by complex solutions. You have to look for complex solutions of the Einstein equations describing this process. And nobody has even tried. So one goal of this research program is to ultimately find. We have some ideas already on how this might work. But I hope you see the spirit of this. It's minimalist, okay? We know a huge amount about physics, the Higgs boson, gravity, the cosmos. A lot of it works, but there's some big mysteries. I think the spirit we need to approach the next few decades is one of minimalism. Don't just invent some new particle, some new field, some extra universe, some bubbles we can't see. You know, focus on what we know and try to extend it in the minimal possible way that you can. And then you may find it fails. Then, okay, then you're forced to do something else, right? But don't give up on simplicity. That's my main message. I think there's a lot of evidence for simplicity. And basically, we need fundamental new approaches which will help us to explain why things are so simple. Okay, last question from a young woman. I see there are lots of you here, which is great. Okay, and I just want to mention that Perimeter is particularly determined to bring more women into physics because it is so boring that it is a male-dominated subject, and we have to change that. So we have the Emmy Noether program. Emmy Noether is not so famous as Einstein. You know, but Emmy Noether discovered what energy is. That's pretty important. And momentum, if you ever wondered, why is there something called energy or momentum? And why are they conserved, right? Usually don't explain to you in physics. But Noether is the one who discovered why. Okay, a very deep explanation. Anyway, so go ahead.
Maybe they seem more simple as we investigate them further. Like
yes.
So when you say that, maybe these pictures that people draw may turn out to be more elegant as
right.
We study them further.
Absolutely. So one example is a very good example, and this is rather recent development. You know, if you learn particle physics, you will learn that there are 120 different kinds of particles, okay? There are W bosons, and they can be left-handed or right-handed, and there are top quarks and down quarks and up quarks and strange quarks, and muons and all of that. And when you count all of the different possibilities, actually 120. And the graviton, including the graviton, the Higgs boson, it's a lot of particles. I mean, it sounds very complicated, right? And one of the big mysteries is that this 120, I mean, it's divisible by, well, yeah, the 120 combines 90 what are called fermions, spin half particles, and 30 bosons, Higgs boson, graviton, photon. Okay, the 90 is divisible by 3. Okay, it's 30 times 3. And what happens is that there are 3 generations of those guys. Okay, so there are 30 bosons, and then there are 30 fermions times 3. It's a bit strange. Okay, so I think this is actually a big clue. And it may be that those other copies, they literally come in 3 copies. It's called the generation problem. There are 3 generations, electron, muon, tauon. Okay, and all the fermions come in 3 copies. They differ only in their mass. They have the same charges, the same couplings. They differ in their mass. So you say, what about this pattern of particles? Okay, surely there's something deeper underneath it, right? So it's like when you do chemistry, there's this huge periodic table, but seems like a big complicated mess until you realize they're just protons and electrons, protons and neutrons and electrons, right? You have proton, neutron, electron, you can make the whole periodic table, right? Atom is just a nucleus with electrons going around. So the same thinking leads you to think, well, maybe with the elementary particles, maybe they're not so elementary, there's something else from which they are made. So one of our young researchers here from China, his name is Zheng Chenggu, has a very exciting hypothesis which might explain the 3 copies. It's inspired by condensed matter physics. Again, I told you how superconductivity inspired the Higgs boson. The theory that inspires this new work is called the quantum Hall effect. So this was discovered in 1980. That particles in certain 2-dimensional materials, that electrons have some very, very surprising properties. And the quantum Hall effect, and then the fractional quantum Hall effect, showed that these electrons, although they only have unit charge, when you put them together in a 2-dimensional material, they have a collective behavior which is completely surprising. So, for example, they have a particle-like entity which has fractional charge, 4/5, or 9/11, or 3/7. Okay, and you find these things which literally behave like particles with fractional charge. And so one of the ideas we are pursuing, many people are interested in, is that the quarks, you know, the quarks have charges of 1/3. 1/3 and -2/3 in units where the electron is 1. So one of the ideas we're pursuing is that maybe some of the particles are very fundamental, and the other ones are somehow collective excitations of those particles. And personally, I believe this is a very, very, very promising idea. It's much simpler. You reduce the number of ingredients rather than increase. And there's even some evidence that it's on the right tracks. Yeah. All right, I think I better go, but I look forward to meeting you again. And maybe next time you'll tell me more about what you've learned. When is the end of the program?
Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Tomorrow is the closing ceremony, and they okay. Get on the bus on Saturday.
Oh, I wish I'd asked you more. So have you enjoyed it here?
Yes.
Which of you are staying in physics? Don't be shy. I see those hands. Okay, well, good luck. And I hope I'll be able to say goodbye to you tomorrow. Thanks for coming to Perimeter.